Nightfall comes early during hunting season. The shortest day of the year is only a month away. It was long after dark on a Friday evening when Charlie and I set off up the woods road that led to his camp on the mountain. The wind had backed around to the north during the day, and with the setting of the sun the air had turned bitter cold. By reflected starlight we crunched over a fresh crust of snow. On the hillside below us, down toward Mossy Cascade, a tree split suddenly with a booming sound, while around our chins our breath froze white on wool coat collars. A night cold enough, Charlie's father used to say, to freeze the balls off a brass monkey. After about half an hour, the cabin loomed through the trees, dark against the hillside. The floorboards of the little porch had frozen while they were wet and creaked loudly under our weight. We wrestled the galvanized steel porcupine shield away from the door. The padlock was frozen stiff. We heated the key with book matches and tried again. The door swung open at last to a still, icy blackness that seemed even colder than the woods outside. Quickly we lit a kerosene lamp, stuffed birch bark and kindling into the cook stove, and touched a match to them. The little blaze struggled against the plug of cold air in the chimney, and smoke leaked from every crack in the range. But in a minute it began to draw. The smoking stopped, and we stood together in front of the firebox, holding our hands, palms down over the black iron top, pretending that we felt some warmth from it already. We luxuriated in the sights and smells of camp, birch smoke, kerosene, brown and gray wool blankets hung from the rafters, and the antlers of the huge buck that Charlie had shot, his first season back from the Navy, after 5 years away. Charlie's camp was built in the old way, a board platform on posts 16 feet square, with walls studded up to 6 feet, three small windows and a door, rafters in a pyramid rising from the corners of the building and supporting a heavy olive-drab canvas roof, a Korean War surplus tent. Wood range in one corner with an old stained porcelain sink close by, food shelves, a tin bread box, and an old wooden cheese box for silverware. There were two-tiered bunks built into two corners, and a box stove big enough to hold a fire most of the night, but big enough, too, to drive everybody out onto the porch if the damper were carelessly left too far open. The place was lighted by kerosene lamps. The stove at last began to throw enough heat to warm the camp. We pulled chairs up in front of the oven and sat quietly, sipping Jim Beam from metal coffee cups, talking about the next morning's hunt, and listening to the crackling of the fire. Neither one of us wanted to take the axe and pail and go for water at the brook, yet one of us would have to before long. The subject hung unspoken in the air between us. After a while, Charlie's chin dropped slowly down toward his chest, and he fell asleep. I counted the ticking of the stovepipe and was just about to doze off myself when a sudden small movement caught my eye high on the wall above the breadbox. I turned my head and saw a little white-footed mouse walking slowly along the 2x4 plate at the top of the frame wall. I know that mice usually scurry or scamper, but not this one. He was walking. He moved without hesitation, but almost as if he were stiff. No wonder. It's a miracle he wasn't frozen solid. When Charlie's father had built the camp years before, he had solved the problem of insulating the cook stove pipe by running it through a section of 10-inch clay sewer pipe set into the wall just below the plate. The clay pipe always got warm, but never dangerously hot. The mouse seemed to be heading right toward it. On he came, with an occasional pause to make sure we were still in our chairs. He passed over the china shelf, the door casing, the kerosene lamp and its wall bracket, and came at last to the clay pipe above the stove. With a slow motion, amazing in one so tiny, he tentatively reached out one forefoot and tested the temperature of the pipe. He must have been satisfied there was no danger, because then he stepped down onto the pipe, settled down in the classic pose of a library lion, and wrapped his long tail around him and over his nose. All the time his eyes never left my face. He knew that I saw him, but he didn't seem to care. Cold is a hunger that drives us to desperate actions, and the fellowship of the freezing is, paradoxically, a warm and trusting one. So there we all sat for the better part of an hour, enjoying the radiance of the stove and the lamp. Eventually, I decided to go get the pail of water after all. As I came back in the door with it, stamping my feet, I stood eyeball to eyeball with the mouse for several long moments. He sat motionless, steeped in the fumes of the whiskey on my breath. He'd obviously decided that whatever the fates accorded him in this relationship, it had to be better than freezing to death in his icy nest down behind the bread box. I reached into the carton of food we'd carried up with us and fished out a piece of chocolate chip cookie. I set it very carefully on the clay pipe about an inch from his nose. The last thing I saw that night, just before cupping my hand above the lamp chimney and blowing out the light, was the gleam of his little black eye up in that corner above the stove. In the morning, both he and the cookie crumb were gone.